This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 6th, 2008. From Berkeley, California, I'm Anitra Grisales. In today's program, Super Tuesday has come and gone, and both the Democratic and Republican nominations are still up for grabs. Israel continues airstrikes following Hamas's first suicide bombing in Israel in over a year. And intelligence officials say Al-Qaeda is still the greatest threat to national security. All this and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Violent tornadoes in the southern U.S. have left at least 48 people dead. The storms, which began last night and lasted through the early morning hours, tore through parts of Alabama, Arkansas, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Mississippi. Rescue crews have been sent to search for survivors in the debris of former homes. The tornadoes are the deadliest to hit the region in almost 10 years. The federal government has filed legal papers in a U.S. district court in San Francisco arguing that veterans are not entitled to mental health care, Africa Jones reports.
The Justice Department argues that while the law says that veterans are eligible for health care, that does not create an entitlement to any particular kind of care beyond medical services deemed necessary by the Department of Veteran Affairs. The DOJ also argues that even VA-approved medical care hinges on the availability of funds. The court filing came after a judge denied the government's request to dismiss a class action lawsuit filed by the Veterans for Common Sense and Veterans United for Truth. They accuse the government of illegally denying mental health services to some troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. Plaintiffs say that over 600,000 disability claims have not been processed, and over 120 veterans commit suicide every week. The government claims they have improved VA services by hiring more mental health professionals. The plaintiffs' attorneys intend to request a court order to compel the government to treat veterans seeking mental health care at their next hearing on March 7th. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
The British government announced today it would send three more battalions to Afghanistan. It's one of the largest mobilizations of its kind for the UK since the Second World War. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
There are no signs whatever that Prime Minister Gordon Brown is willing or able to loosen the ties of the so-called special relationship between the US and the UK. This week is critical for the future of Afghanistan and indeed for the future of the NATO alliance. Canada may be about to pull out of Afghanistan altogether. Germany is refusing to send its troops into the more dangerous south. And there is growing tension between the US and other unwilling European partners. Condoleezza Rice was greeted by protesters in London today as she tried to step up the pressure. The US ambassador to the alliance has already challenged Europeans to match us soldier for soldier, euro for dollar. Failure to find an additional 10,000 NATO troops will leave current forces vulnerable to a spring offensive by Taliban fighters. And that may repeat the experience of so many previous foreign forces in Afghanistan's history. NATO defence ministers will meet in Lithuania tomorrow. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A lawsuit brought by the American Civil Liberties Union against a San Jose aviation company accused of participating in CIA extraordinary renditions may not have its day in court. The presiding judge is weighing arguments from the Bush administration that court hearings on the case could expose state secrets. The company, Jeppesen Data Plan, allegedly contracted with the CIA to fly kidnapped terror suspects to countries known to practice torture. ACLU staff attorney Ben Wisner accused the CIA of misusing the state secrets privilege to avoid judicial oversight and accountability. The state secrets privilege has been used in the past to exclude pieces of information from public disclosure, but the Bush administration has used it repeatedly to urge judges to throw out or block entire lawsuits. The Indian state of West Bengal observed a 24-hour shutdown strike today to protest the police shooting of demonstrators at a rally yesterday. Bismila Gilani reports.
Today's shutdown strike in West Bengal closed schools, offices and business establishments and affected all forms of public transportation across the state. Police arrested nearly 200 strike supporters for resisting the removal of makeshift barricades in the state capital, Kolkata. The strike was called by the All India Forward Bloc, a constituent of the state's left-front government, to protest deadly police action taken against a rally yesterday. The rally in the state's Cooch Behar district consisted of 15,000 villagers demanding work under the Rural Employment Guarantee Program and the cancellation of plans to build factories on local farmland. Police opened fire on the rally, killing 6 protesters and injuring many others. The state government has ordered a judicial probe into the incident. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Super Tuesday has come and gone, but the Democratic presidential race has no clear frontrunner. And Republican John McCain still has a long road ahead of him before he captures his party's nomination. Meanwhile, scattered complaints around the country of voting machine failure and poll accessibility leave election watchdogs concerned for those unable to cast their vote, but pleased that no major nationwide meltdown occurred. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Speaking to supporters in New York, Hillary Clinton said she's the one who can deliver on day one. She also focused her attention on the Republicans.
They see tax cuts for the wealthy and they say, why not more? They see $9 trillion in debt, say, why not trillions more? They see 5 years in Iraq and say, why not 100 more? Well, they've got until January 20th, 2009, and not one day more.
Clinton won less states than Obama, but won the states with more delegates. California was a big win as Latinos again provided strong support. She also won her home state of New York and neighboring New Jersey. And despite Senator Ted Kennedy's endorsement of Barack Obama, she won Massachusetts. Older white women had high attendance at the polls, and a good majority of them continued their trend in supporting Clinton. Meanwhile, Obama continued to gain the support of African Americans, youth, and rural areas. He also won his home state of Illinois. He pulled out a crucial victory in Clinton's backyard, Connecticut, and he won by large margins in the southern states of Georgia and Alabama. But his strength continues to be in rural states such as North Dakota, Kansas, and Idaho. At his speech to supporters, Obama also criticized the Republican candidates' positions.
The Republicans running for president have already tied themselves to the past. They speak of a 100-year war in Iraq. They talk about billions more in tax breaks for the wealthiest few who don't need them and didn't even ask for them. Tax breaks that mortgage our children's future on a mountain of debt at a time when there are families who can't pay their medical bills and students who can't pay their tuition. Those Republicans are running on the politics of yesterday. And that is why our party must be the party of tomorrow. And that is the party that I intend to lead as President of the United States of America.
On the Republican side, John McCain garnered a huge win in California. It helped to propel him to clear front-runner status.
We won primaries in the West, the South, the Midwest, and the Northeast. And although I've never minded the role of the underdog and have relished as much as anyone come from behind wins, tonight, I think we must get used to the idea that we are the Republican Party frontrunner for the nomination.
Disappointing to Mitt Romney, who came out with just a few states on his side. That included his home state of Massachusetts, where just about 50% of the vote supported him. But Mike Huckabee is pleased with his performance, getting strong support from the evangelical voting bloc. Republican Ron Paul had a strong showing in some states, but because of many Republican primaries that are winner-take-all, he received few delegates. As for voting irregularities, they were reported across the country. They included machine malfunctions in New York and New Jersey, and voter ballot confusion in California. But Doug Chafin with Pew Trust ElectionLine.org had staff on the ground in 5 states. He says the outcome was nowhere near perfect, but better than anticipated.
What was actually interesting about yesterday is that while we did see the kind of problems that we've come to expect, you know, machines not starting up and the like, that there weren't the kind of widespread problems or statewide problems that we sometimes see in other elections. There were, you know, if election problems were the dog that didn't bark yesterday, there were lots of dogs that didn't bark in voting technology. The biggest technology-related problem yesterday seemed to be a lack of ballots in places. This rising level of turnout on both sides of the nomination race is really challenging election officials to have enough ballots on hand for the voters who turn out to the polls.
The final delegate count is still to be determined, and the race in New Mexico has yet to be called for the Democrats. But Democrats now turn their attention to the upcoming states of Louisiana, Washington, and Nebraska. The Virgin Islands has 9 delegates to offer this Saturday, but campaigns have no scheduled stops there. Republicans, meanwhile, will speak at a conservative conference Thursday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The president's $3.1 trillion budget proposal is stirring debate on Capitol Hill. The proposal includes over $500 billion for defense, but cuts all or part of at least 150 federal programs. Medicare, Medicaid, and other social programs are on the chopping block. Tanya Snyder has more from Congress.
It's not the first time President Bush has submitted a budget with huge cuts in domestic programs and more money for war. And as usual, the Democrats are fighting back, like Senate Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus at a hearing today on Medicare cuts.
We're not going to solve a problem just by whacking the bejeebies out of Medicare or Medicaid or not giving benefits to CHIP. That's not going to get at the underlying problem, health care costs.
Secretary of Health and Human Services Michael Levitt defended the cuts, ringing the alarm bell about the consequences of continuing the current rate of spending on Medicare.
If we allowed it to continue to grow on autopilot, Medicare will essentially run out of money 11 years from now. And if it's allowed to continue beyond that, within 30 years, it would subsume every piece of the federal budget. Everything we spend for defense, everything we spend for highways, everything that goes to education, everything that goes to R&D would be taken up by Medicare. This is an emergency.
President Bush's budget aims to bring the country out of a deficit by 2012 by cutting spending. Medicare would be cut by $182 billion over the next 5 years and $556 billion over 10 years. Nursing home care, prescription drug benefits, and other health care programs are also in danger of seeing their funding reduced. Federal assistance to state and local governments are also slated for deep cuts, including Section 8 housing vouchers, EPA programs dealing with clean drinking water and hazardous waste, child care programs, community development, and other social services. According to Anita Donch, research director of the National Priorities Project, these spending cuts don't get to the root of the deficit.
Those deficits aren't being really caused by the expansion of social programs. They've really been caused by tax policy changes and by these enormous increases in military spending, including the enormous more than $500 billion for the Iraq wars.
But besides getting the deficit under control, Health and Human Services Secretary Levitt supports reducing Medicare spending, saying that turning to a market-based approach to rising health care costs just makes economic sense.
Government decides who gets treated. Government decides how much they get treated. Government decides how much value should be allotted to each different procedure. It's an inefficient system, and it has contributed substantially, in my view, to the dilemma that we face today. If consumers were allowed to make these decisions through an efficient market that the government would need to organize, their decisions would be far more precise and, in my judgment, wise.
Senator Baucus responded by accusing the administration of trying to privatize health care programs.
You've asked for huge draconian cuts, which this Congress is not going to enact. I might say that your budget request also sounds very much like you're trying to, say it bluntly, privatize Medicare.
Meanwhile, the government continues to increase spending for the military. The administration requested $70 billion for just the first few months of 2009, with no indication of how much will eventually be needed for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan next year. Add to all that $541 billion in non-war military spending, including funding for nuclear weapons. James Horney of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities warns of more hidden costs in the president's budget proposal.
And at the same time, the president is proposing tax cuts that would cost $900 billion over the next 5 years. Those are tax cuts totaling $2.4 trillion over 10 years, and most of the benefits of those tax cuts go to the most well-off Americans.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
We'll be right back.
Intelligence officials in a hearing before the Senate yesterday gave their analysis of the main threats to national security. Al-Qaeda remained at the top of the list. Naji Mujahid reports from Capitol Hill.
Leaders of the United States intelligence community, including the directors of the FBI, the CIA, and the DIA, addressed the Senate to give their annual threat assessment. The Director of National Intelligence, J. Michael McConnell, asserted that while the U.S. is not safe, it is safer since 9/11.
Al-Qaeda remains the preeminent terror threat against the United States, both here at home and abroad. Despite our successes over the years, the group has retained or regenerated key elements of its capability, including its top leadership, operational lieutenants, and a de facto safe haven in the Pakistani border area with Afghanistan.
McConnell went on to expound upon the growing threat of Al-Qaeda affiliates in the region as well, particularly in the areas of northern Africa. The CIA director, General Mike Hayden, was no less emphatic about his perception of Al-Qaeda, referring to them as ruthless and adaptable and inferring that they gave them cause to be, quote, no less resilient and creative. Later, he would balk at the idea of the CIA having to follow guidelines from the Army Field Manual on interrogations. General Hayden.
The Army Field Manual does exactly what it needs to do for the United States Army. But on the face of it, it would make no more sense to apply the Army Field Manual on interrogations to CIA than it would be to take the Army Field Manual on grooming and apply it to my agency, or the Army Field Manual on recruiting or apply it to my agency, or for that matter, take the Army Field Manual on sexual orientation and apply it to my agency. This was built to meet the needs of America's Army. We should not confine our universe of lawful interrogation to a subset of those techniques that were developed for one purpose.
In addition to their accusing Iran of continued nuclear ambitions, Lieutenant General Michael Maples, the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, reported on Iran's weapon acquisitions and claimed that they continue to support other so-called terrorist groups in the region.
Iran is acquiring advanced weapon systems and supporting terrorist proxies. New capabilities include missile patrol boats, anti-ship cruise missiles, surface-to-air missile systems, and an extended-range variant of the Shahab-3 ballistic missile. Iran is close to acquiring long-range SA-20 SAMs and is developing a new Ashura medium-range ballistic missile. Lebanese Hezbollah continues to receive weapons, training, and resources from Iran.
Another component to the national security threat assessment that was a recurring theme between the witnesses was the threat of so-called homegrown terrorists and cyber terrorism. Senator John D. Rockefeller IV would question FBI Director Robert Mueller about this and imply that disenfranchised people were prone to radicalization and malevolent behavior.
People become attracted to a cause. People have to have some meaning in their life. They're disenfranchised economically or in their own minds, and they want a cause to give their life meaning, even though it's malevolent meaning. It's a very powerful factor.
Addressing the war in Iraq, no one on the panel gave the impression that an end to the current occupation of the country would be forthcoming. Reporting for FSRN, I'm Naji Mujahid of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Violence continues along the Gaza Strip. Today, Israeli airstrikes wounded at least four Palestinians as Hamas continued firing rockets into southern Israel. The Israeli army killed nine Hamas-affiliated fighters and police yesterday in southern Gaza, just after the ruling Islamist movement claimed responsibility for a suicide bombing in the southern Israeli town of Dimona. Hamas says the bombing was in response to continued Israeli attacks on Palestinians. FSRN's Rami Almagari goes inside the story.
On Tuesday, Israeli military stepped up attacks on Hamas's fighters in the Gaza Strip in what Israel says in response to the first suicide bombing attack inside Israeli territories in more than a year. Israeli media is reporting that Israel is considering carrying out a large-scale offensive on Gaza in order to completely undermine the ruling Hamas party. According to Palestinian Man and News Agency, the proposed plan eventually calls for the installation of an international peacekeeping force in Gaza. FSRN asked Hamas spokesperson Sami Abu Zuhri of the group considered the overall political impact of resuming the so-called martyrdom operations.
There is a blockade. There are restrictions in front of the people and all the roads are closed.
First of all, we are a people who love peace, and we never look forward to carrying out suicide bombings. However, the siege Israel has been imposing on us, with crossings closed, no food and no fuel, have all created frustration among the people, leading to such operations.
The latest bombing attack in Israel came on the heels of Israel's strict border closure into and out of Gaza since the Islamist group took over the region in June of last year. The United Nations Security Council, due to U.S. veto power, failed last week to pass on a non-binding resolution that condemned the Israeli closure of Gaza borders and cuts to fuel supplies for Gaza's 1.5 million residents. In Gaza, Palestinian political science professor Mchemer Abu Seda says that the Israeli army's actions on Gaza have been the root cause of the Dimona bombing, which claimed the life of an old woman and wounded 11 others, including many slightly.
Israel has been targeting the Palestinians, has been inflicting sanctions and siege against the Palestinians, especially in the Gaza Strip.
Asked whether the last Dimona bombing will have an impact on Palestinian-Israeli peace, Abu Saada comments.
The voices which we have heard over the past 2 days, that some extreme right wings in the Israeli society, that they have been asking Olmert to freeze negotiations with the Palestinian Authority, in my opinion, as I mentioned, that there is no peace process right now, and there is a stalemate in the Palestinian-Israeli negotiations.
In the streets of Gaza, Palestinians blame the Israeli government for Palestinian resistance attacks on Israelis. Abu Muhammad is a 50-year-old agricultural engineer.
The Dimona operation is a natural response to the occupation's continued crimes and the siege. There is an international silence and an American backing. Consequently, we have no other choice but to keep away the harm our Palestinian people suffer from. Hamas will commit to the legitimacy of resistance with all possible forms against the aggression. And if the international community were really concerned about calm in the region, it should practice pressure on the occupation for the halt of all the occupation's crimes against the Palestinian people.
On January 23, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians flooded from Gaza into the nearby Egypt to buy essential supplies amidst a crippling Israeli closure of Gaza since last June, when Hamas took over control there after a power struggle with Fatah Party for President Mahmoud Abbas, who embraces a peace strategy. Last September, Israel escalated its sanctions on Gaza with more army attacks on Palestinian fighters and further restrictions of an already underway closure, including fuel and power supplies cut. Israel says its actions against the coastal territory are meant to stop Palestinian homemade rockets fire from Gaza into nearby Israeli towns. As of filing this report, this rocket fire has not yet ended. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
In a bold move to take back national territory from private interests, the Ecuadorian government declared last week that it's revoking hundreds of mining concessions across the country. Though the decision spares most transnational mining companies with large-scale investments, at least one community in northwestern Ecuador is celebrating. The foreign Ascendant Copper Corporation will lose two important concessions from a project in Intag, one of numerous communities resisting large-scale metal extraction. Residents see the move as positive, but would like things to go much further. Jennifer Moore reports from Quito.
Current conditions are very favorable for private and foreign mining investment in Ecuador. Mining concessions for up to 60 years are permitted, and the only allowance for cancellation under present law is failure to pay minimal conservation fees. This was the reason cited when the government announced it's revoking 587 concessions just over a week ago. From his high-rise office in downtown Quito, José Serrano, Undersecretary of Mines, says that sorting out Ecuador's more than 4,000 mining concessions is part of a larger project to re-regulate the mining sector.
One of the first aspects of putting our house in order is reviewing all of the mining concessions to determine which were granted in accordance with the Constitution and the law, and which were granted against the Constitution and the law.
Remaining concession holders, he says, will be able to renegotiate their mineral rights on terms more beneficial to the country.
Que esos proyectos se sometan a
These projects will undergo a transformation, including new environmental, technical, and economic guidelines, and obviously payment of royalties. Only on this basis will they be able to take the next step.
Ascendant Copper Corporation is headquartered in Denver, Colorado, and listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. It was the only foreign investor whose projects were seriously affected by the recent announcement. In a press release last week, the company says it intends to vigorously defend its rights and will take appropriate action upon further study with its Ecuadorian legal counsel. Jose Cueva, part of the INTAG coordinating committee uniting local government representatives, communities, and social organizations in INTAG, says it's about time the government acted against Ascendant.
I believe they've had sufficient arguments in order to terminate these concessions for a while, but perhaps they've had to take the time to find their legal rationale, given how favorable the law is for corporations.
However, conflicts over large-scale metal mining projects go far beyond INTAG, and Cueva says the government should go further.
I believe that this is a step by the government to respect its sovereignty over natural resources, but it's still a small step with regard to the mining issue at large.
A further decree on mining that could cancel the majority of remaining concessions is currently being debated by the National Constituent Assembly. Community delegations visiting the National Constituent Assembly in Monte Cristi in recent weeks argue that the government could apply Ecuador's current political constitution to annul all mining concessions across the country, given violation of their right to prior consultation. They're also proposing a different development model altogether. Jose Cueva says Ecuador and mining are incompatible.
Ecuador is mega diverse, small, and the most densely populated in South America. Mining areas overlap with the areas of agriculture, of water supplies for major cities, and of rural communities. They practically surround a number of protected areas.
Naturales protegidas.
Vamos o no a permitir minería metálica a cielo abierto. Yo creo que no.
The community proposals have some support. Alberto Acosta, former Minister of Energy and Mines and current President of the Constituent Assembly, has consistently supported the idea of an Ecuador free of large-scale open-pit mining. He's also said that mining should not take place in protected areas or near sources of water. However, with heavy lobbying of both the government and the National Assembly by industry representatives, and with the government planning to both regulate and participate in the new mining sector, alternative proposals could face a long haul. But those struggling for a national alternative to the extractive development model say that their efforts are also just beginning. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jennifer Moore in Quito, Ecuador.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments at fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Monica Lopez and Tana Gysi. Headlines editor, Shannon Young. DC editor, Leanne Caldwell. And the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Antonio Ortiz, Eric Klein, Puck Lowe, and Rose Katabshi. I'm Anitra Brisales.